ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Hello, and welcome to episode 212 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. We're here today with Michael Harrison, founder and publisher of Talkers Magazine. Michael is the founder and director of Talkers Conventions and is known in the industry as a radio maverick. He's a former editor, publisher, columnist, and consultant for four trade publications and is a former program director at four major market radio stations. Michael is also a former owner and operator of a radio station in Springfield, Massachusetts, and is the producer of hundreds of hours of music and talk programming. He's been a professional on-air broadcaster for years and is now a guest on Public Interest Podcast. Michael, thank you so much for joining us today. How are you doing?
Doing fine. Thanks for having me, Jordan. Sounds like I can't keep a job.
It's a pleasure to have you, a man of so much, such varied experience within the industry. So with all that experience, I'll ask you to answer the first question I'd like to pose to you, which is, what are you currently doing or what have you ever done to advance the public interest and why?
Would it freak you out if I said I haven't done a darn thing to advance the public interest? Because I tend to be humble about those things. I find the people are quick to tell you how much they've done to help the public are usually just being self-promotional. So I don't think I've ever done anything where I was working with an organization to help the public interest or to change the world. But after I know your podcast and I know you asked that question, so after thinking about it, I guess an honest answer would be that I have always encouraged radio licensees who are licensed to serve the public. I've always encouraged them through my own work as a role model and through the platforms that I've developed in the trades to really take these responsibilities seriously. I'm a great believer in serving the public interest from any platform. One of my mantras is to seek truth, not victory, which I think is a major problem with our society today. We seek victory at the expense of truth. You see it in politics, you see it in sports, you see it all across the board. I believe that the First Amendment, which is the only political ideology that I espouse. I am very nonpartisan in my public work, other than the First Amendment, freedom of speech. I believe that the First Amendment is the very foundation upon which everything that we consider to be American is built. And I devote a tremendous amount of my work, my writing, my speeches, and my efforts to supporting free speech. Even in sometimes it means supporting people with whom I disagree, defending their right to say whatever it is they're saying. And that's it in a nutshell.
So have you ever found through the course of your career that the First Amendment has been under attack, and have you had to defend it?
Have I ever found that the First Amendment is under attack? That's all I find. The First Amendment is constantly under attack. The First Amendment is very fragile. The First Amendment is complicated to understand. And even the most ardent supporters, people who will say, of course I support free speech, well, saying it is one thing, practicing it is another, especially when it comes to supporting the right of someone to say or stand for something with which you disagree. It's very easy to support the First Amendment when you are supporting somebody's right to say something that you agree with, but somebody says something repugnant, if somebody says something that you think is dangerous or, heinous, oh, that's a whole other story. And the only way that free speech can live and remain vital and functioning is if people defend it, even if it means defending the right of those with whom you disagree to be out there saying what they say.
Well, in reference to the First Amendment, which came about an amendment to the Constitution, so it was the late 18th century, you have another 18th century man, Patrick Henry, who once said, I may disagree with you, but I'll defend your right to the death to say that, or I'm paraphrasing, something to that effect. Have you ever drawn inspiration from that quote?
Yeah, sure, of course, because as I said, there's if you're not willing to defend somebody's right to say what they're saying, their right to say it based on the First Amendment, we can talk about what the First Amendment means, but if you're not willing to defend that, then you're not willing to defend America, because without the First Amendment, you know, we might have a red, white, and blue flag, we might say "In God We Trust," we might say "E Pluribus Unum," we might have all of these platitudes and symbols and, you know, the bald eagle and all the things that we, you know, rah-rah about that makes us feel like we're Americans. But all of it is empty and shallow, hollow, and absolutely without any power if there's not a vital First Amendment to back it up.
So let's go down that road of determining what exactly the First Amendment means, because if you're in a crowded movie theater and you shout fire and there is no fire, that clearly is not protected by the First Amendment. So to what extent, if you incite violence, if you incite destruction, you know, that is not protected by the First Amendment. So how does someone know? But then, of course, you may find that the ACLU supports, which is American Civil Liberties Union, supports the right of the Ku Klux Klan to espouse hateful speech or march on Washington. So to what where do you draw the lines? What is the litmus test of something protected by the First Amendment and some expression of speech that really is not protected by the First Amendment?
Well, first of all, the First Amendment only protects citizens and Americans from being censored or censured by the government for their political opinions or for their artistic expression. It doesn't protect you from the backlash that you might get. It doesn't protect you from other people's free speech. It does not mean that you can write a letter to the editor and guarantee that your letter will be there, or call a radio station and that they will put you on. It doesn't guarantee you that you will be able to speak at a private college, or that you can do anything. It doesn't guarantee you a soapbox. It doesn't guarantee you a platform. It just guarantees you that the government cannot stop you, punish you for your opinion. Now, obviously, all of things that are the law, there's the letter of the law and there's the spirit of the law. And this is where abstract intelligence and reasoning comes into play. And this is where someone like me can't say, well, here's the line. Here's what you can do and you can't do. You've got to have education. You have to have intelligence. You have to have flexibility and understand. So if somebody uses speech specifically to create harm that is measurable and obvious, you know, there's no fire in the theater. You yell fire, people stampede and trample each other. Well, that's obviously a very dangerous act. That's always the example that's used. But no, if you're going to microscopically look at it, obviously there's a very fine line that is subject to interpretation. That's why we have judges, and that's why we have the spirit of the law as opposed to the letter of the law as part of the law. That's why we have degrees of legal interpretation: first degree murder, second degree murder, third degree murder, manslaughter. So I'm not going to get too deep down that rabbit hole with you, but I will say that when it comes to political speech and a very loose interpretation of what's considered hate speech is in many cases not the same as somebody maliciously inciting violence that can cause harm to people in a measurable way. I think that we're very loose about how we interpret these things, and people have been very quick. Political correctness has perhaps created a very bad picture of many good causes, because they go too far in accusing people of being haters, when in fact they're not haters at all. They just are repugnant or even hate. Do we have the right to express hate? That's a very interesting question, because hate is a subjective determination. Suppose that I wanted to hate you. Do I have the right to hate you? Maybe I do. but I don't necessarily have the right to kill you or to harm you. So these are areas that we as a free society based on the First Amendment and the granting of freedom of speech, we've got to have better education. We have to have better discussion. We have to have better communication with each other so that we can navigate these complicated waters of what is hate speech? What is the difference between marching and demonstrating for something that insults large groups of people and besmirches their backgrounds and their heritage, their ethnicity, their color, their race, their religion? What's the difference between that and telling people that they should flee the theater because it's burning when it's not, knowing that that's going to cause death and suffering? And we have a lot of work to do in being an enlightened and an educated society in dealing with these very, very complex and sticky issues.
So, Michael, you mentioned the need for better discussion. In previous interviews, you've mentioned that you're very attracted to creating a sense of community within the talk business, and that was one of your primary motivations for creating Talkers Magazine. Can you speak about your motivations of creating community, your methods for how you're able to create a community within the talk business through your magazine, and how all of that leads to better discussion, which in turn makes for a more vibrant democracy?
It doesn't necessarily. As I disclaimed at the beginning of this conversation, I'm not 100%, you know, Mother Teresa. I'm a businessman. I work for profit. My company is a capitalistic business. I am not a nonprofit. I'm not a priest. I run this business to make money. I sell advertising. I am not, you know, pure. I would be a hypocrite to claim that. I like to do good, but that doesn't mean that I am some type of a saintly person. But I am an honest person. That being said, when I talk about creating community in the radio business, that's because I'm a radio freak. I love radio. I don't love radio because I love humanity. I don't love radio because I walk around obsessed with free speech and I'm obsessed with public policy and doing good for humanity. I just love the radio business. And I am a booster of the radio business. I support the radio business. I love radio people. I just love the whole culture of it. I've been into radio since I'm a kid. And so I create community within the radio business because I think it's good for the radio business to have the atmosphere of a community where people know each other. It's good for my business to do that. It creates interest in my conventions. It creates interest in my magazines. It creates interest in my products. It's good business to create a community. You have a podcast. The podcast that we're talking about on right now would have a larger reach. It would be more successful. It would be more lucrative if it were a money-making venture, or it would be more influential as a social instrument if you created community, if the people that were patrons of it, if the people that listened to you, followed you, saw themselves as part of a community as opposed to just out there alone buying Coca-Cola. You know, there's not a community of Coke drinkers, but there is a community of people that drive Harley Davidsons. And that's the only thing I mean by it. So I don't know whether or not there's necessarily a connection between my creating community and my caring about the First Amendment. There are different parts of my personality, different parts of my brain. Although, if I do have a community of people that are part of the talkers world within the radio business, I have more influence to be able to encourage them to do some of the things that I think are, you know, back to your original premise, good for the public and good for society. But it's not necessarily my primary and my sole purpose.
So, well, creating community is something that's quite difficult abstractly for many different organizations to do. Concretely, logistically, many organizations are seeking to create communities. You mentioned in a previous interview, again, something that you referred to as the magic of radio. And today you mentioned how you love radio. You also spoke about how you do like to do well while you're doing good, but more than anything, you just like radio and you're trying to just be involved with what you love. Can you speak about the magic of radio and perhaps opine on how that may be responsible to some extent for creating this sense of community with Talkers Magazine?
Well, I think radio is a wonderful theater of the mind. It's an area of show business. It's an area of entertainment that is not just show business and entertainment, but it's educational, it's informative, it brings people together, it's good at creating community, but it has a magic to it. The whole idea of something coming through the airwaves, and of course, you know, this is, we're looking at the radio I grew up with that influenced me. Radio today is not quite like that. But the idea of, you know, listening to a station from out of town under the pillow, you know, with the AM trans, the transistor radio, and you hear the static, and it's coming to you. It's almost magical. You know, DJs and radio announcers and radio theater were like Wizards of Oz, you know, coming from behind the magic curtain. So that's what I meant by magic. Not as magical anymore. We're in the age of Facebook. We're in the age of Twitter. We're in the age of social media. We're in the age of amazing computer technology where people can make movies in their home on their laptops. People can broadcast podcasts and online radio from their basements. The magic of 20th century media is now the utilitarian culture of 21st century media. The silver screen, you know, I was interviewed in the newspaper. Oh, your name was in the newspaper. Look, my picture's on the front page. You know, big superstars at movie theaters, hearing people on the radio, television stars, all of that stuff has lost its luster here in the 21st century when everybody wants to be followed in Twitter and liked on Facebook. Everybody has their own peanut gallery, which is a reference back to the Howdy Doody audience. You know, everybody is a star in the 21st century. So I guess that my love for the magic of radio harkens back to the golden age of radio, which is what influenced me. And I'd love to see radio maintain that magic because I think it makes radio stand out in a world where there's far more media competition, far more exotic technology, and new generations of humanity that are growing up without understanding what life was like back in the 1980s, 70s, 60s, the 50s, the 40s, or earlier than that, which are long ago and far away. I mean, we're in a whole new world. We're 17% of the way through the 21st century already. And the term magic has lots of different meanings. I can go on forever about that, so I'll cut that short. But there's no concrete answer to your question.
So, Michael, you spoke about the magic of radio being like the Wizard of Oz. So I'd like you to take our listeners behind the Wizard's curtain in the Wizard of Oz and speak a little bit about the mechanics of action, the business of actually running radio and what's going on. You speak about a transition to the 21st century utilitarian culture. There's increased debt, there are budget cuts in radio stations and media conglomerations that are increasingly consolidated. You have fewer small companies operating independently. You have exotic media rivals, as you mentioned, blurry ratings, and you're having generational cultural shifts where millennials are growing up without having much exposure at all to traditional terrestrial radio. Can you take our listeners behind the Wizard's curtain and show them exactly what's going on in media today? How are we getting our content, and why does it matter? What is the impact of the change on the public discourse?
I got to, first of all, I have to compliment you. You are a good listener. You recited back to me every talking point that I just made, and that's a pretty rare quality, so I salute you. You're a really good interviewer. And one of your strengths, Jordan, I've never spoken to you until today, one of your strengths, and I think a very important part of being a good interviewer, is being a good listener. So I'm really impressed, and I feel like I'm in good hands talking to you. The question you ask is, again, a very, very, very good question, and it's kind of prompts me to just want to talk for hours. I could talk for hours about what you just said. So as I'm gathering my thoughts, I want to give you as cogent and specific an answer as I can so as not to, you know, unleash a torrent of words. in the 21st century, all 21st century media has been disrupted. Radio is in very, very challenging times. Television is in challenging times. Newspapers are going through an enormous transition, trying to find their bearings in this new environment. Every medium based on the 20th century, in which everything was isolated, you know, newspapers and magazines were print. Television was a medium that you could only consume on a TV set, on a television, you know, with a rabbit ears or plugged into your antenna. Radio was AM and FM. And for many of the years of my youth, it was just AM. I was part of the revolution when FM was like being on the internet. It was exotic. But it was a radio, and there was a radio in every room of the house. There was maybe one or two TVs in the house. The newspaper came to the front door. There were middlemen involved. And there was a whole business-to-business paradigm based upon that structure. That's gone. So all of these 20th century media are having to figure out, how do we go about creating a business-to-business, a business-to-consumer structure so we can make money? How do we create box office? How do we get people to pay for this? For example, the record industry back in the 20th century, they weren't selling music. They were selling vinyl. They were selling vinyl, and the vinyl was worth a lot of money because it had these magical grooves that contained this this ephemeral abstract concept called music. But they were selling vinyl. They were selling cardboard that the vinyl was encased in, and making it magic, back to that word, by you have to have this vinyl in order to hear the music. Newspapers were selling paper. They were selling paper and ink. They weren't selling stories. The stories were magically embedded in the paper to make the paper valuable. Why would you go out and pay for paper? Because it contained this intangible thing called news and stories. Now, that middle media, paper, vinyl, a radio station that is licensed to be on an FM or an AM dial, the television dial, channel 2, channel 4, channel 5, channel 7, channel 9, channel 11, channel 13, and then all of the ultra-high frequency stations, were commodities that were rare. That's all old hat. It's completely digital. There's no tangible middleman. There's no trucks. Look at what Amazon has done to the retail industry. We're going through a very painful, challenging evolution from the bricks and mortar and tangible, measurable products to the selling of pure information, pure data. And that's the problem facing 20th century based media, is that transition from the tangible to the intangible. How do you monetize it? And that's the best way that I could put it. In terms of radio, radio's dealing with the fact that there aren't any radios anymore. There are radios in cars, but more and more people are listening to radio online, even in cars. The talk about the connected dashboard, the wired dashboard that's going to come, and what are people going to do, or what's going to happen when there are driverless cars and all that, it's already happening. The combination of a smartphone and Bluetooth is all anybody needs. Most modern cars have Bluetooth. You plug your iPhone or your smartphone into that particular component, and voila, your car is now connected to the internet and to everything in the world. Why does anybody need to invest in an AM or an FM radio station with a tower and electricity and a transmitter and licensing and regulation from the FCC when you're no longer on that magical dial that is the only place people could get you? That's part of the problem facing radio. And in terms of the run-up to consolidation, where you used to have lots and lots and lots of individual mom-and-pop ownerships, owning stations around the country, when there was deregulation in the late 20th century and they loosened the rules about how many stations one company can own, Well, everybody started to sell their stations, and we wound up with these mega corporations that own hundreds and hundreds of radio stations under one corporate umbrella, the result of which it became a very unwieldy business to run, considering that concurrent with the run-up to consolidation, we also saw the devaluation of the radio stations that they were paying enormous money for because of the 21st century changes in the digital era. So most radio stations today are operating under a stifling debt, which takes away from their ability to invest in programming and promotion, two of the most vital aspects of having a successful radio operation. And that's the problem in a nutshell.
Well, that is quite a nutshell. It's a coconut size nutshell.
Was that more than you expected?
Well, that's exactly what our listeners need to hear. I think it's a rather concise history of the transition between a new technology of the mid or the early 20th century all the way to the new technologies of the early 21st century. So thank you for that brief history of media from Farnsworth and before that Faraday and Edison all the way up to Zuckerberg and the Google folks. So I guess we are coming to the end of this podcast episode, and I would like to ask you a final question, which is to reflect on your work in radio as the radio maverick. And I know that you have a great deal of humility and don't like to canonize yourself. So I'll try to frame this in a way in which you could answer it. Suppose that you're speaking to your annual Talkers Convention, which in 2017 has happened on June 2nd in New York City. So suppose that you're talking at that convention to all of those attendees, and I'd like you to speak to them about why it is that talk radio matters, whether it's consumed digitally, whether someone's accessing it through a dial. Why does it matter? What is its role? What is the national dialogue? How does that advance the public interest? And more than anything, what do you hope will be the legacy, if not of yourself, which I'd love to hear, then what is the legacy of Talkers Magazine and Talkers Conventions? Could you speak to these attendees of the Talkers Conventions about why it is that they are doing what they're doing, what impact it has on the public interest, and what you hope the legacy will be of their work?
Well, I think that it's very important for the people that are involved in talk radio to understand that talk is one of the key components of being a human being, that we are the talking animal, that we have language. And I don't know, maybe birds and bees buzz and tweet to each other in ways we don't understand, or dolphins talk too. But we humans have a great facility for communicating complex ideas through words. We also are great storytellers. I think the need to communicate through words, oral, you know, from the mouth to the ear, which is a very special psychology of how that works, I think that this is something that will certainly transcend how it's being listened to or what the business model is, as you pointed out in asking the question. I encourage everybody in this business to maintain the idea that there is magic in storytelling. It doesn't matter how it's coming or whether or not the people think you're a celebrity or you're a mysterious person or some kind of a star. There's magic in storytelling, and there is tremendous importance in telling the truth. One of the things I failed to mention earlier when you asked me about the changes in media is that in the 20th century, news organizations were operated by bigger corporations as a loss leader because they were proud to have a good news operation. In the 21st century, news operations, news and talk and newspapers and cable TV and all these things we have, are the same in the same corporate category as a game show or a dramatic series. They're about numbers. And instead of going out there and let the cards fall where they may for informing the public, educating the public, or creating non-partial, non-biased dialogue for the sake of finding facts and figures and truth, they target audience based upon preconceived notions and kind of support people in what they already think. That's a very dangerous syndrome of the present day media. And I encourage people in the talk radio business not to do that. Don't try to tell your audience what you think they want to hear so they'll like you. Gather the audience a different way. Gather the audience by putting out there what you believe, what you think, what you've learned. Try to be true. Try to find truth over victory. And I believe that is something that will keep you vital and serve the public interest at the same time. There's no better business than doing good. Doing good. Give people what they need. Help people. Help people with their problems. Help people with their pain and their suffering. Try to uplift the human spirit and the human condition. That's a great way to do business. That's what I hope I'm remembered for, if I'm remembered for anything. I don't think I'm going to be remembered for much because I think that we live in a time where almost everything is forgotten in 5 minutes, which I feel sad about, but I'm not going to worry about how I'm going to be remembered. But the principle of that, I hope, is remembered, and I feel very strongly about it. Seek truth, not victory, and you'll probably win in the end anyway.
And that has been Michael Harrison, the founder and publisher of Talkers Magazine and the founder director of the Talkers Conventions, a radio maverick, a former editor, publisher, columnist, and consultant for various trade publications, a director of programming for 4 major market radio stations, former owner and operator of a radio station, producer of a lot of content over many years for music and talk programming, and an on-air broadcaster who speaks about this abstract concept of truth within the construct of the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. He speaks about a need, which he reiterated very many times, about seeking truth, not victory, as a means of articulating what it's essentially. He's offering the American people a dinner plate, and he's saying, there's your peas, there's your carrots, there's your meat, and then, of course, there's dessert on the side. And he says, in today's economy, in the 21st century, dessert is equivalent to your peas and carrots. And in fact, dessert may even make you more money than peas and carrots, but ultimately it leaves you feeling bloated. You have a little bit of teeth decay. You have some obesity. It's not so good for you. Michael speaks about the need to offer a balanced meal. He offers the American consumer a truth which will make them an informed an electorate to participate in our democracy. And then he also offers fun. He offers magic. He offers rock and roll. He offers entertaining. But he says that this radio, this theater of the mind, is also educational and informative. It offers you your nutrients that you need in addition to the dessert. He speaks of a shift, a transition to a more utilitarian culture of 21st century media. We're seeking to make profits and we're streamlining businesses. And where there are diverse outlets for media consumption and fewer editors for media. But ultimately, Michael speaks about talk radio as being important to our society because talk is a key component of humanity and that we, human beings, are the talking animal. And the magic of storytelling is intrinsic to our very humanity. And so, therefore, the advancement of the public interest is the recognition of that which defines our very humanity. And through radio and through Talkers Magazine, he seeks to make a small community that he hopes in a small way will be able to contribute to the perpetuation of that great gift of storytelling. So, Michael, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us today.
Jordan, it's been a pleasure being with you. And again, I'm very impressed with your ability to absorb and listen to some complex ideas and take them even to a more articulated level. It's been a pleasure talking to you. I thank you for having me on this podcast.
This has been another episode of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. I'll remind you to subscribe on publicinterestpodcast.com and on iTunes. Leave a review of this podcast on iTunes and listen on Stitcher, SoundCloud, CastBox, Blueberry, Player FM,
Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube. Should you wish to comment on this episode, you're welcome to leave a voicemail at 240-630-0380. And the first 3 minutes of that voicemail may be played in future episodes of Public Interest Podcast. Should you wish to support the podcast, you're welcome to leave a contribution in an amount that you feel comfortable with at publicinterestpodcast.com. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.